Discussion keeps the world turning.
This is Round Table.
You're listening to Round Table with myself, Her Young. I'm joined by Lai Ming in the studio and Josh Cotterell on the line coming up. To tread or not to tread? While some Chinese parks enforce strict keep-off-the-grass policies, others embrace the idea to open invitations. We discuss the changing landscape of recreational norms in green spaces in China. And we invite you to the realm of blandness, where everything is dan-dan-de in Chinese, where life's vibrant hues are painted in soft strokes. Join us as we ponder the wisdom found within a bland state of mind. Life happens, we get it. Miss the juicy bits on air? No worries. Dive into the Roundtable China podcast for the discussion and insights. Find us on your favorite podcast platform and let the fun catch up with you. Roundtable is your space for meaningful conversations. And we want to know what's buzzing in your thoughts. Drop us an email or voice memo to ezfmroundtable@foxmail.com. Let's turn your thoughts into on-air magic. And now on Roundtable, as we move on to our next topic of discussion. Please keep off the grass. That's a common teaching heard by Chinese people since childhood. But in recent years, as camping gains popularity in China, more green spaces that were previously reserved solely for admiring the scenery are now being opened up for entry. Nevertheless, it's worth noting that in urban areas, public green spaces predominantly showcase ornamental lawns. This is often attributed to concerns over heavy foot traffic causing significant damage if these areas were accessible. Why are some lawns designated for viewing while others are open for foot traffic? It can be a little bit confusing, and despite both being large green spaces. Lai Ming, I guess we need to go from the Chinese perspective. First, why is walking on grass sometimes forbidden? Or always forbidden in my childhood memory?
Yeah, in my childhood memory, it's the same thing. Growing up, I remember looking at a sign in the garden in my school, and it would always say,
had a lawn in school?
Yeah, there was.
We didn't. It was all concrete.
Okay.
But please keep
well,
on going.
Well, you have the benefit of living in a metropolitan city like Beijing. Whereas I lived in a small county, and we can afford lawns, of course. But we also need to spend time taking care of them every week.
Well, what do you do?
Little students, we pick up garbage and water them.
Oh.
Yeah. So there's always a sign, and the sign isn't always strict or demanding, like keep off the grass. Sometimes it's a nursery rhyme, like a verse.
Okay.
So it's sometimes poetic, sometimes it's artistic, and sometimes it personifies the grass and saying, oh, these are living beings. These are alive. Try and protect them. Don't step on them. Don't kill them.
All right. So I'm alive. Be a darling. Don't step on me. I'm grass.
Kind of,
that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. All right. So there are many different kinds of signage, I suppose.
Right.
Basically, to convey the same message.
Mm-hmm. And I think people feel differently when they look at the sign like that, because I imagine people living in urban area like Heyang will look at that with much regret. I mean, this is a huge patch of grass supposed to be stepped on. We want to get close to nature because that's the only opportunity you get. Whereas in my hometown, I was used to running wild in the rice field and on the path. I mean, there are paths between different rice fields. So we have the opportunity to get close to nature. Mm. So in our opinion, the lawns were purely meant to feast our eyes all upon. So they were part of the decoration. We didn't want to ruin them.
Yeah. It was only when I went to other countries did I realize, or more spacious countries with small population, grass is something that you can step on, touch, and also like trees, you can touch.
You can't hawk them.
Yeah. But for years I just used to think that, okay, these are only for appreciation of the eyes. And Josh, yeah, I suppose you would have a different perspective on walking on grass.
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, in the United Kingdom, grass is, it really is, it sounds funny, but it's a really important part of our culture. In the UK, it rains a lot, so grass grows really quickly. Grass needs rain. And if you go to countries with a lot of rain, or even in parts of China, right, where it rains a lot, you'll notice that the grass is noticeably thicker, right? Especially if you go to like Inner Mongolia and places like that as well, right? Like the grass is sort of thinner and thicker and it grows quicker. It's same in the UK, but it actually requires a lot of maintenance and it can easily be ruined if it's trodden on too much. So, and also when I think about grass, what I think about is football. And in the UK, football is really important for our society as a whole. And it's difficult to really exaggerate how important it is in our society. And we play on grass. We don't play on AstroTurf and things like this a lot of the time. People do. They play football anywhere, but we play on grass pitches. So the maintenance of those pitches and the maintenance of the grass is sort of, we kind of all understand it. So when we see like don't walk on the grass, we take it pretty seriously. And usually it's done in rotation. So there'll be different parts of the park, different football pitches, for example, being rotated and the grass being allowed to grow. So I'm quite passionate about walking or not walking on the grass, Hyung.
Yeah. So in your book, should everybody be freely roaming on grass whenever?
No, not whenever.
Okay.
It should be done in a sustainable way. So for a certain amount of time. And then what you should do if you have enough space in a park, for example, is, as I mentioned before, sort of rotate parts of it. So depending on how big it is, you could even leave it for months or even like half a year. You could corner off part of the park, let the grass grow, and then swap it around, you know, allowing people to use the grass in certain areas. So it's all about being sustainable, much like farming, I guess.
And what you're saying there is real grass, like no fun traditional, okay, kind of fun for some people, grass. But what we see in big cities a lot of the times, these are literal grass carpets. You know, I've seen those gardeners and workers who roll the grass carpet up, you know, is it every few weeks or whatnot? So because letting the grass to grow on that land, let's say in some little green space at the intersection of a crossroad area in a big city like Beijing or Shanghai, that doesn't happen. So for the appreciation of the eyes of everyone, and then the most cost efficient, well, actually these can be quite expensive, but the fastest way to bring that lawn greenery scenery to you is to roll out the grass carpet, and that's how it's done. So therefore I can understand with this kind of arrangement, you can't really just go on and, you know, trampling on that area because you're gonna break the carpet. But that's just the way it is.
Compare them to tiles. They are brought in, they are bought and brought in and laid on the dirt to cover the barren dirt that was supposed to have endured the winter time. So every year, and now this spring, and you can see workers working outside trying to lay the tiles or carpets on the barren soil. And so here, it really depends on where you live. In northern China, like the city of Beijing, it can get very dry. We don't get a lot of rainfall. So grass don't usually survive the winter. So it's always a lot of trouble and a lot of hassle and a lot of cost to try and plant new grass and try and keep them maintained. So I can understand why, at least in this part of the country, the gardeners or the park rangers are more strict with what pedestrians or visitors are supposed to do with their foot and the grass. Whereas, for instance, in a southern city, perhaps when we get more rainfalls, the rangers can afford to be lazier as compared to one that's working in northern China.
That's so true, because the climate in more of the southern cities and areas in China, then you don't need to worry about grass because it grows wild easily, and it has a lot to do with climate. But also, don't you see that there's possibly a well-intentioned obsession towards having these beautiful green lawns in China's urban planning, or more of, I guess, the every year assessment of how well urban performance is, that a lot of city management want to have or reach a certain goal of having enough or a certain amount of
green space.
Yes. And therefore, even if it's half artificial, or maybe this is just, you know, addressing the symptom, but not addressing the root cause, but at least just get the greenery, whatever it is, onto the scene.
Yeah, just a while ago, we talked on the show about pocketpox and the regional government's efforts to try and boost the percentage of green space in urban areas. And this is very important, especially for people who may have originally grown up in a small county where they've been exposed to nature and they're now being forced to live in urban areas. I mean, I, for one, certainly miss my childhood when I could get that exposure to nature. And so there's a lot of benefits to have that green space. It clears up the air. It allows people to breathe. It allows the city to breathe. So it's actually very important. I mean, the government isn't doing it for no right reason. This is obviously very important.
Mm-hmm. Well, Josh, I'm sure you have some strong feelings and thoughts about having that greenery that is not only meeting the eye, but something you can immerse yourself into and touch and maybe roll on it. Or maybe I'm just imagining things now.
No, I think that you're right. And there's actually a lot of studies that support the notion that it's really important. There's a report by the World Health Organization that stated that access to these kind of spaces, all green spaces, not just grass, but anything green, obviously being wildlife, plants, it's linked to improved mental and physical well-being, reduced stress and things like this. Obviously an increase in physical activity in those areas. You find that people are usually fitter and more active. There's also a study published in the Journal of Environmental Health Perspectives found that these kind of spaces contribute to, again, unsurprisingly, better air quality, temperature regulation, stuff like this. I'll give you one more. A research by the Trust for Public Land indicates that parks and green spaces contribute to property value appreciation, economic development, and community cohesion. Ooh. So it's just endless, Hyeon. Mm. There's so many good things. And it's easy to forget sometimes when you're living in the rat race, the hustle and bustle of the city, right? I think that sometimes, and we're buried in our phones and stuff, but even if you are rushing to work and stuff like this, and you know, you don't have that time to spend maybe rolling around in the flowers, as you said, or something like this, right? It's still helpful just for your everyday life. As I said, air quality, right? Fitness, just people around you smiling a bit more, right? I don't know. But either way, it just makes life, the quality of life, much better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And here in China, we've only just begun building our city to have more green space. Perhaps a few decades ago, people were looking to the modern kind of living, the metropolitan kind of living. People would much rather hang out in the shopping mall as compared to, you know, out in the wild, because what's there to see? A few generations ago, we were all living in the countryside. What's fresh about that? But in the recent few decades, we managed to urbanize in such a rapid rate that we're not really used to living in the concrete jungle that are springing throughout the country. Also, the kind of infrastructure and investment that we've been able to afford in recent years has only just begun. As such, young people are especially getting used to a new kind of lifestyle. We talk about on the show the tendency or the popularity for people to go camping in whatever space they can find, maybe in the rural areas or in suburban areas. But this is certainly taking off, and people would like to get close to nature. They would like to find a piece of grass where they can stitch their tent and then try to boil some coffee and maybe walk their dogs or throw some frisbees. The lifestyle has somehow changed as compared to maybe a generation ago. People would like to simply hang out in the malls.
That's so interesting, because I think already you're referring to a few generations of people. And these days, if you say like 3 years as a generation, then do your math.
It is a generation.
Yeah. So now I think already we've got a few generations of Chinese young people who grew up in concrete jungles where nature does seem rather alien. And I've actually seen my neighbor camp on his balcony.
Oh, that's so sad.
I don't think he deserves the awe, but probably he's longing for a different kind of lifestyle amidst, you know, the rat race, all these stressful things that we talk about on the show of city life. But yes, getting in touch with nature, I think everyone will be pleasantly surprised with the benefits that it brings you. But it also poses challenges to these ever-growing cities in China, because right. easily you can see that another city in China has grown to attract and host more than 10 million people. And then when you're talking about like such a huge number of people and providing the necessities of shelter, and now we're talking about green space as well. And it is quite a daunting feat, but this is what I think the government and relevant parties are trying to address the need of.
Everything comes down to cost. In New York, Manhattan Island, in the Central Park, every year you can expect about 20 million visits to the park. And even though it's comparatively small number of people, if you compare that to, for instance, a park in downtown Beijing. But again, they have to spend several hundreds of millions of dollars trying to keep the plants and the vegetation in good shape. And they're supposed to close off the lawn every year near the end of the year, like November through April. So it's costly business. It takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of resources. Likewise, here in China, if we were to allow the kind of population to step on grass, then the frequency and the kind of care that's required really is enormous. And I'm not sure any city, however rich it is in terms of its economy, has the kind of budget to keep the lawns in good shape if everybody is allowed to step on it.
So, but we're still seeing changes, right? So now we're seeing that some of the grass areas are open to the public and some are not. You kind of just have to look for the sign, right?
Yeah, some parts of the city, for instance, in Beijing, allows people to step on the grass and sometimes even stitch their tent. Like the Olympic Green Area, the park that was built in the lead up to the Summer Olympics in 2008. I mean, I enjoy it so much because it's wild, but it's also well cultivated. It's a well-cultivated kind of wildness as compared to the kind of green that I experienced as a child. So that is a good place. And then in northeast Beijing, the Wenyuhe Park is where people will go and allow their kids to indulge in the sand pit and also stitch their tents. So there's a growing number of places that allow people to and try and get close to nature, but I think this is a response to the growing demand from the population.
Yes, and access to green spaces is important for public health and recreation, and how these spaces are managed affects the quality of life for urban residents. And the debate around walking on grass involves policy decisions and park management strategies. Balancing public access with conservation efforts is a significant consideration for authorities and the general public as well. Coming up next, step into the serene oasis of blandness. Come along and explore the tranquil depths of a dandanda state of mind. Stay tuned.
Looking for passion? How about fiery debate? Want to hear about current events in China from different perspectives? Then tune in to Roundtable, where East meets West and understanding is the goal.
It's the hour of Roundtable with myself, He Young. I'm joined by Lai Ming in the studio and Josh Cotterell on the line. The phrase, everything could be a bit bland, or dandanda in Chinese. A bland state of mind is a popular phrase to convey the idea of a subdued or indifferent attitude towards things, and that's just my translation.
Yeah, it's a very literal translation. Bland as in this tea is bland, this drink is bland. This life is bland. I'm not sure I want to use that word to describe my life, though I try to be calm as I deal with my everyday encounters. I'm not sure if that's the correct translation. I would translate this into, let's say, a tranquil state of mind or a serene state of mind, free of overreaction or exaggerated emotional response to things happening around me. I think this is a comeback of a word that was popular a few years ago. I mean, perhaps more than a decade ago, there's the word of dan ding.
Yeah.
As in but the indifferent ding, and calm.
Yes, and the ding kind of refers to a certain kind of firmness, and then you are certain about your decision. It's not like right. you're drifting along. And with dan dan de, I think we have similar but a little bit different of interpretation. And Josh, what would the translation be like for you?
Yeah, it's actually a little bit tricky to translate, but I think that the concept is understandable. I guess that, yeah, this word bland is what it would be directly translated mm-hmm. to in English, something like bland-mindedness. But it's not a great translation because bland in English usually implies some sort of being bored or like lacking in some sort of substance. But it seems to me that this is more nuanced than this. It's sort of a mixture of quite strong emotions, which doesn't seem like bland at all.
Oh,
and
really?
It almost seems like, well, because it's like a detachment, right? It's almost like a numbness to it. So I guess that probably, depending on the situation, it would almost maybe better be translated to feeling numb to something or detachment. But I get the bland-minded. And also, I think bland-minded is quite a good translation in some ways because it sounds quite funny to me. It's quite a strange thing. And so it's like, and it is a new concept, right? So if coining a new concept requires, I guess, a new phrase. And bland-minded is definitely a new phrase. So,
yeah. Interesting.
So in some ways, I think it fits perfectly.
Yeah, blandness in the eye of the beholder, I guess. And the three of us have different ideas about this, which is great. And that's why, you know, that's key purpose of Roundtable, having different opinion and sharing them. And what's said in the comments section, because this is being talked about by a whole bunch of people. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a completely new concept, but it's certainly trying to use new words or a pattern of words to capture a certain kind of phenomenon.
Well, some people are using it in the way they interpret it. And some people would say, well, having an hour-long commute on a daily basis makes me want to move closer to my workplace. But the prospect of doubling my rent gives me a second thought, so I just stay put. This is a description of a dan-dan-da mentality. I know ordering takeaway of ready-to-cook food is not that healthy, but it's after 8 and I get home and I'm in no mood of cooking, so never mind, that's it. After we say hi on the dating app, the chat goes back to silence. Oh. It's not like we don't like each other, it's just we both know we wouldn't meet just to satisfy the vanity of wanting to be favored by others, so never mind, let it be.
Let
it be kind of attitude, and I'm not sure that's the kind of attitude that I would use to interpret the prevailing lifestyle or philosophy that I see the society experiencing. Because ever since a few years ago, my wife and I have started reducing the flavors in our food.
Oh, I mean, thank goodness, it's the
vinegar,
food.
Vinegar, sugar, you know.
Okay.
And this somehow has allowed us to get a finer taste about any food that we put in our mouth. When we were young, we were very much into hot pot, very spicy, very, very salty, and you get all sweaty from eating that hot pot. But I don't know. I mean, when we reach a certain age, when we try to dial down on the, you know, condiments, we feel like we are in a better position to taste and tell the differences from different kind of food. And this somehow has deepened our understanding and our experience, life experience. And that is a nice thing. And I hope maybe on some level, the society is doing the same thing. Or maybe on some level, we are doing exactly what the society is doing.
Okay.
Trying to be dan-dan-de.
All right. Well, I saw this other comment from some married folk. Basically, she said, I'm married, and it's not like I don't love my husband, but it's been a few years. The passion has obviously fizzled out, and I'll just dan-dan-de continue with my marriage. I'm not complaining. So, yeah, I don't really know what to make out of it. So, Josh, we've provided a few scenarios, and you're shaking your head. I know you're an artist in heart, and I know dan-dan-de will probably not produce good art for some reason. So, thoughts, huh?
Well, I think that actually the situations and the hypothetical examples that you've given, some of them not being that hypothetical, right? Some of them being real examples that you've read from stories online about people being falling out of love or becoming disillusioned with their marriage or losing emotion. It seems like there's quite a lot of different things going on here, because I think that there's like emotional overload, which can cause people to detach, right? There's only so much feeling that the body can take before its natural defense mechanism is to actually detach from itself and sort of dissociate, they call it, right? But in that example you gave of the woman who fell out of love with her marriage, that
she
really
says she's
just
still
sounds
in love.
Like, she's still in love.
Yeah.
But it sounds like she's lost some passion, right? Mm-hmm. Which is sadly not uncommon. Mm-hmm. And so that really just sounds like something different to me. Mm-hmm. That rather sounds like it's not an emotional overload, but rather that she's just lost a lot of passion in her marriage. But we're using the same phrase here. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that this phrase is sort of being used for quite an abundance of different feelings right now, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Yes, I think we can agree. The popularity of this phrase, dandanda, is partially due to the fact that it can be all-encompassing. And it also conveys an almost passive-aggressiveness for some people, not all. Mm. Oh, see, Liming doesn't agree, which is fine.
Because there's a famous saying, 平平淡淡才是真 in Chinese, and like the okay. blandness is the reality of life.
Yeah, and that's the... Oh, nice. Okay. All right, it can have positive connotations. I grant you that. And nobody can stay on a high forever or sustain unending positivity. So allow ourselves these dun-dun-da moments. It's like when you realize you're running low on gas in life. Then ease off the accelerator and find a nearby gas station. Grant yourself reprieve and renewal. That could all be dun-dun-da. But at the end of the day... And I know your mileage may vary, but according to He Yang, I find it a necessity to ultimately reignite with passion and flame.
Or you're a firework.
But I've got my dandan moments too. And for it is this fiery spirit that fuels us, our resilience, and propels us forward on this path of life to happiness and greatness, hopefully. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you so much, Josh Cotterell and Liming, for joining the discussion. I'm He Young. We'll see you next time.